It's November 9th, 2020. This is the 24th of our continuing series. If you go to the Torah in Motion website and look under podcasts, because you can also view these, listen to these podcasts, this is the 249th class. So next week, God willing, it'll be an auspicious occasion. Before we get going, a number of people emailed me to say something about the two very important figures who we lost this week. So let me just spend a couple minutes on that, and let me share the screen. The first is just about Rav David Feinstein, who I did not know personally. I mean, I see at least one person I'm looking at right now on the screen who did know him. I can't say, like I said, I didn't know him. I know about him, obviously. We just posted on the Sfarim blog, incidentally, a couple hours ago, a nice article about him by Professor Jonathan Boyarin, who studied with him. Much of this comes out of Boyarin's book that appeared last month called Yeshiva Days. He's an anthropologist. He earlier wrote a book about his time at the Stanton Street Synagogue. He likes to sit and observe and listen and write about it. That's what anthropologists do. But he's been learning in Ramosha's Yeshiva now for a long time, or he was, and he wrote a whole study of, as it says, an intimate and moving portrait of daily life in New York's oldest institution of traditional rabbinic learning. When they say the oldest institution, that is not correct, though. Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Hanan is older, and Torah Vadas is older, but okay. And he's a very good anthropologist. Now, if you want to get a sense over who he was, I recommend going to, you can, Yeshiva World News, other places, you can watch the eulogies, the Hespedim of Rav Moshe, of Rav David. We're fortunate that two family members spoke. I have to say, and I hope this isn't disrespectful, that often when you listen to great rabbis' funerals, it often, you have all the rabbis speaking and it sounds like drushes. And you come away from it not knowing anything about the people. We were fortunate that for Rav David, his son spoke. His son wouldn't remember me. Maybe by name he wouldn't, but I think he would remember me because he was very helpful to me 30 years ago. He brought me into Ramosha's small apartment. They still had the apartment after his grandparents are no longer alive. And he let me look through Ramosha's papers to find letters from Yechiyak of Weinberg. And I found a number of letters. So I'm very grateful to him for that. And then Rav David's grandson, who I know quite well, a number of people on this in this class must remember him as well. For all the comments he used to make on the classes. He told me he hasn't been here for the last few months because he's busy with a great zechus he had helping with his grandfather. But I think you can listen to both these hespedim and you get a sense of the righteousness, the sitkus, the hasmada, the learning, the personality, and it obviously is a great loss. Rav David was a posek, a Rosh Yeshiva. He didn't really write. Maybe he wrote and didn't publish it. And his son described how it was only after his father passed away that he really came into his own. But it is a great loss. And one thing in particular that the son said that struck me, and it reminds me very much like a Brisker mentality. He said when at the end, his father couldn't fast, Rav David couldn't fast on Yom Kippur. But he wasn't upset. Why should he be upset? That's obviously the Ratzon Hashem. Now he's weak. So his job is not to fast. And that's what makes, that's the halakha. For a person like that, the feelings aren't what is important. The feelings go through the halakha. And the halakha is he had to eat. So of course, that's what, also there was talk by the son, things we've mentioned, the mimetic tradition, that he Masorah was very important. I guess in a sense, he's not quote orthodox from what it is today, because today with all the new ideas that often new chumras, new changes, things of Rav David, it was about Masorah. So if you come to him, what you found in the Sefer or something, he says, but that's not the minhag. And I want to show you just, I mean, there's a number of interesting videos you can find online. One of them is, you see in the upper right hand corner, there's a Parah Aduma, looks like a red cow, Rav David going to visit it outside of Lakewood. It's very unusual to have a red cow. But there's a video from the Halachan Organ Donor Society, and I'll just play you a minute of it, because in other videos you see this also with Rav David. He really he says it like it is. And the issue is, how do you define death? Because if you define death as a lack of breathing, well, then that they brain death, you're no longer breathing anymore. But many people hold that it's not that. It's also, there has to be the stopping of a heartbeat, which means you can't have heart transplants or anything like that. So you can just hear Rav David just saying it shortly. He doesn't even, if you listen later, he doesn't even want to get into debates. He doesn't, he does say he doesn't know if his father, doesn't think his father would approve of the organ donor cards, because he thinks, he says that then you put the organ in like a bank. But that's, we know that's not true. As far as I know, organ donor, you take it in immediately. But just listen, he's very strong and very no nonsense.
My father's position was very simply that the stopping of breathing is a point of that's death. It doesn't matter if the heart is functioning or it doesn't function. As long as he stops breathing, he's considered dead. That's the way he explained the Gemara in Yumen. That's the way he said they always did in Europe when the Chevra Kadisha went to test if a person is dead or not. They always just to test his breathing and nothing else. I'll repeat again the same thing. If the breathing has stopped, then he's considered dead. And that's it, nothing else.
Even if the heart's still beating.
Right.
Right.
And anything else is not a contrarian.
Okay, so very interesting there. Now, as for of Jonathan Sachs, who I did know, what can we say? First of all, it was an enormous shock. We heard a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I think it is, that he had cancer. And I assumed, as I think everyone else did, that this was like something beginning stages and like everyone else, he'd go through chemo and hopefully things would be okay. But it came very quickly and it was quite shocking. I asked a rabbi in England today, and he also said that they had no idea that it was so serious, and it came as a shock to them as well. The there's a lot we can say. Hold on a second. About Rabbi Jonathan Sachs. First, if you want to hear, unlike Rav David, Rabbi Sachs had a very small funeral. You can see video if you go to his website. Just a very, unlike Rav David, who, which is very large, very small funeral. In fact, I watched the eulogies today. I didn't know what those little flowers were. I asked the same rabbi today that I mentioned about just about Rabbi Sachs. I asked him, what's this, these little flowers? And he told me that's, they call it the remembrance poppy. That's, they start wearing it a few days before Armistice Day, which is coming up on Wednesday. It's the 11th. Remember, it, the war ended, World War I. The first, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And that's Dying Beanstalk. And you can see the other eulogies there. And there are so much important things. I think probably the best article I saw was this one. No, that's the remembrance poppy I want to show you. Hold on. Where is it? Here. By Alon Goshen Gottstein, who wrote about, he focused mostly on Rabbi Sachs's involvement with interfaith because that's his thing. There's so much to say about Jonathan Sachs. Let me just say in 3 minutes and tell you about a personal experience because I think it says something about him. He's obviously going to be someone that we write about for a long, long time. He, the fact that the leading public Jewish public intellectual was an Orthodox rabbi really says something. I don't know where he found the time for all the reading. He reviewed my first book, actually. He reviewed and he wrote so much. You wouldn't have expected what he became when he was an earlier rabbi and even when he became chief rabbi. At first, he's writing to the Jewish community, and then he begins writing for the world at large. He becomes the most popular clergyman in England, speaking on the BBC, elsewhere, and he becomes an international figure. And the rabbi everyone knows, with enormous influence. He was successful beyond anything anyone can imagine. And the one area, perhaps you can say, it wasn't so successful, or people didn't like it, is being a chief rabbi. Because what happened was he became this international figure. It's as if you have a your local pulpit rabbi publishes a book, it becomes a bestseller, and every day he's being interviewed and going around the world. People in the community are going to feel, well, what about us? And I would go to England usually once or twice a year to speak when things were normal. And I would always hear that when he was chief rabbi, that, you know, he's so famous in America and around the world and among the non-Jews. But, you know, I think many of the local Jews in England, but when you think about it, felt that they were missing out. But England's a small Jewish community, and the chief rabbinate, it has an august title, but it's a... it represents the United Synagogue, represents really a very small number of Jews. The Haredim aren't represented at all by it. So it's easy to see how Rabbi Sacks very quickly, and you can read the biographies, he really grew out of this. And although he continued as chief rabbi, the things that I guess they wanted him to do, he was so beyond that. And he became the moral voice, and it's just that you can go on and on. So let me just tell you one quick story I had with him. I didn't know him that well. We corresponded and other things, but I came to England in 2008. I looked it up because I was over Shavuos. I was at the St. John's Wood Synagogue. It's a very nice synagogue there. And Sacks asked to speak to me beforehand. And we had a nice conversation. And then at the end, he gave me Musar. Now, I told this to some people later. They found it strange. I don't find it strange. And I didn't take offense. And it's exactly who he was. He said to me, he enjoys, he reads my blog posts, he does all these things. And he said to me, now it's time to move on. Bigger and better things. He says, I want you to write for the Wall Street Journal. I want you to, he wanted me to be a public intellectual, not just in our little world. He got his wish later, you know, Mayor Soloveitchik. I guess that's that. He said that you have something to say. He says, I want you to do like I'm doing. And Because that's his whole message. And in fact, Goshen Gottstein in his article also mentioned it here, that that Rabbi Sacks was able to expand the we of Judaism addressed by our particular wisdom and make it the we of all religions and all of humanity. The idea was that he really believed in this, that we have what to offer. And what can I say? It's not my interest. I speak to the small groups. I'd rather write about an obscure sefer from 150 years ago for the few people who are interested in that. But I understood what he was saying, that, and I took it as a great compliment that he thought I could do that. I don't think necessarily I could do that. I mean, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik does it amazingly, and you need to have a certain approach. But he really said who he was, and that it was time to really move beyond the parochial and really fulfill this like Hirschian vision of taking, because the Torah is not just for the Jews. Torah values are supposed to be for the world. Sometimes we forget about this. And there was no one, his predecessor was very good at this, Emanuel Jacobovitz. But Rabbi Sacks really went way beyond, and there'll be doctorates written on him and discussions. I wrote a whole article dealing with his views of religion. So that's what I can say about Rabbi Sacks. Just two more minutes before we move on. I just want to call your attention to a couple other things. First, we ended last class, Baruch correcting me with, I said, Klei Chemda. He said, is it Klei Chemda? And I said, yes, I think you're right. But you know, I looked it up. the word appears three times in Tanakh. Twice it's Klei Chemda, and once in Divrei Yomim it's Klei Chemda. So maybe Klei Chemda is okay as well. If you recall, the letter going back a number of weeks, the controversial one where Rabbi Greenblatt says that you can convert, someone who converts under 3 years old, a girl can marry a Kohen, which was controversial because it goes against the Shulchan Aruch. It's actually being passed around. I was forwarded a correspondence. There's all this discussion going around. Why? Because there's this issue if you have a surrogate, what do you do, or donor eggs? There are poskim who hold that the child needs to be converted. Does that mean the child, the girl can't marry a Kohen? If you have this view of Rabbi Greenblatt, it would help a lot. We already spoke about the problems that the sources he cites don't seem, we can't find those sources, although he does quote Rav Moshe as agreeing with him. Nevertheless, I thank Rabbi Michael Broyd, who sent me, Rabbi Eliyahu Abergel. I think I have a picture of him here for an aid. Here he is. Yes, Rabbi Abergel. He's with Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef. In his latest volume of Responsa, Dibros Eliyahu, number 137, he rules halacha lamaisa that you can, a geyoris that's converted, pachos migil shalosh, can marry a kohen. And he's an av based in Jerusalem. So that's of great interest. It's actually, let me spend 5 more minutes and then we'll begin, because I also want to mention something I learned over Shabbos. There's a community in Hong Kong. Here it is. It's called Kilat Siyum. There's an Ashkenazi community, and in 1995, they opened a Sephardic community. There you see the rabbi of it, Rabbi Me'oded. And he wrote volumes of responsa. Stop sharing. And I had seen the responsa, but I wanted to get copies. Here is, for example, a thick volume, three volumes, and they deal with all sorts of questions about China. And not just China, the Far East, Singapore, and I'm very interested in China. I have all sorts of stuff regarding Jews in China. I even have a document for those who listen to Rabbi Dweck from his predecessor a couple centuries ago, Rabbi David Nieto, a manuscript of a letter he wrote to the Jews of China, all sorts of other things. So I wanted to get a copy of the book. And I emailed them, and they never sent it to me. Lo and behold, my son tells me in yeshiva in Israel, who's there? None other than the son of Rabbi Me'oded, the rabbi of Hong Kong. So now I have my opening. So 2 weeks ago, I contact them and I get the book sent. And I read them, a number of them, over Shabbos. And look, there's some wild stuff in this book. Before I tell you why I want to reading it, well, what I mean by wild, well, just to give you an example. In volume three, if you look in... Siman Yud Zion, page 205. This is the question he deals with. First I have to say, he's a pulpit rabbi of a community of Syrians, of Israelis and others, and he has three giant volumes of responsa. He's a Hebron graduate, so he has the Ashkenazic approach. But how many pulpit rabbis do we know write responsa like this? He's a real London. He discusses this case that someone from his community, he has they drink the diamonds. So he has his assistant or something was going to the different local countries. He doesn't say which ones, Vietnam or whatever it is. And the way they arranged the worker smuggled the diamonds in, didn't pay the duty, I guess, because he figured he'd make more money on it. And so then he's arrested, and the boss tells him. Before he goes to trial, well, if you bribe the people, you'll be able to get out. So he tries to bribe them, and now he's in deeper trouble. So the question is the boss who sent them there and told him to smuggle it, is he responsible to pay him for all the harm and suffering for that, as well as for advising him to try to bribe the person, people who arrested them? And he goes through a whole discussion. He even talks about bribery. Can you halachically bribe? And he says in these third world countries, he says that in his opinion, that this isn't really bribery. It's just emtsa'i, kadesha chevra tuchal limkor. It's just a way of doing business. And I can tell you it is true, because I have someone who lives near me who worked 20 years ago. He was in Africa. And the law in America is that you cannot bribe foreign officials. It's against the law. And he told me, though, that it was impossible to get business in these places. The French didn't have this rule. The Germans, you simply couldn't get the contract. You couldn't get the license. So he said that what they would do, they wouldn't bring cash, but they would bring like a gold bracelet to the minister, the vice minister, a present for his wife. And he said that was the only way you can get the contract. So it might be against Dina de Mahusa, but it's not against bribery. So why do I mention this book, though? Because he deals with the question we dealt with. Remember, first week, 24 weeks ago, he was asked about, he's been there for a while, about going into the Soviet Union and leaving your tefillin there. And this is in volume one, number 13. And he says the exact same thing that we saw, that you can leave your tefillin there for a day or two. In the note, he quotes, there was this periodical that came out in Amsterdam. It was called Eitz Chaim. It came out from... 1691, I think, to 1806 or 1807. It was a Torah periodical that came out well over 100 years. And they have the following question. Think about this question, because he gets into the idea of, do you have to sacrifice for someone else? The case that was raised in this periodical was a man comes, his father was very ill, and the doctor said to save his life, the cure was he has to drink milk of a donkey, which is unkosher. Obviously, today we'd say this is a phony cure, but they thought it was a real cure, and he has to drink it. But the father refuses to drink it. He wasn't like Rav David Feinstein. He says, I can't drink non-kosher. Rav David would say, I'm sick. Now that's the halacha. That's, but he refuses to. And so the son's question was, could he bring him? No, so the son brought him milk and donkey milk. And the son lied. And the son told them that it was cow's milk. But the father said, I don't believe you. You drink the milk. After you drink it, then I'll drink it. So the son's question to the yeshiva in Amsterdam, can he drink the non-kosher milk? Because that's the only way the father is going to drink the milk. And the ruling is actually from the Amsterdam yeshiva is no, you cannot. Because, and they say, if this man wants to commit suicide by not following the halacha by drinking it, you're not able to drink. And Rabbi Melodade cites another example from David C. Hoffman, Muhammad Ahola, Volume 1, Number 61, where a woman in Germany, the Orthodox Jews used to go to school on Shabbos, but they didn't write. But his father said, you have to write. And the mother said, if you don't, I'm going to commit suicide. So Rav David Hoffman says, we can't go along with this. Anyone says, if you don't violate this, I'm going to kill myself. So that's, he quotes saying, we can't follow this. But I have a question, the case in Amsterdam. Because if all of a sudden you're home Friday night and your answering machine goes off and your relative or your friend calls you and says, I can't take it anymore, I locked up, I'm going to kill myself. Every one of us would pick up the phone. We get in the car when we immediately go over, violate Shabbos d'oraisa to save the person from killing himself. And every rabbi would say, of course you do that. If that's the case, then how is that different? Think about it. Maybe come up with a different. How is that different than if the man, the father, won't drink the donkey's milk unless the son drinks it? How is that any different? I don't really see a difference. I was speaking, we have a Dayan who listens to the show when we were trying to figure out this issue here. Okay, think about that, though. But that's, you can see it in Otzer HaChma, Rabbi Meodei. These are two of the three volumes. So, and if my son, he listens to some classes, I thank him for connecting me. Okay, we're picking up now in the book. We're in number 95, Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt's page 214. And, Rabbi Malka, Moshe Malka, number 94. The issue we raised with is I was interested for some reason on how a government stopping drugs. Can you have like someone selling it, making believe they're a drug dealer, or is that lifnei iver? And it obviously applies to, you know, all sorts of things. So he writes as follows. This is a long response. And are you a moser if you do it, or is it an issue of lifnei iver? And he begins, the first paragraph is very interesting. First paragraph, he says there shouldn't be any problem with it. After all, what are drugs? He says they're organic, or they come from the ground. They're a plant. How can you say that there's a problem, you know, with a plant? And if you use it properly, he says people use it improperly. That's wrong. But smoking also. Drinking. He says drinking, you can use it improperly, or you can use it properly. So the first paragraph would imply that there's no real prohibition. But then in the second paragraph, he says, but we see this isn't the case because it's absolutely forbidden to be involved with drugs and everything, because we know from experience that once you start, it's not like liquor or anything where there's, once you start, it becomes, you're addicted. And then he goes, so the question is then halakhically, in terms of helping the government stop people. He argues then that it's absolutely permissible. It's a mitzvah because what you're doing is you're helping the community. And anything you can do to help the community, it is appropriate. And you're helping the people as well. And he says he goes on that everywhere in the world, they punish this very harshly. And he cites the Ramah, Ramosha Isseris, in Choshen Mishpat, Shin Pei Ches. He says as follows, Misha Osek B'Ziyufim. He had Jews who were involved in counterfeiting. It's not a new thing that Jews do funny business. We know that Jews, they were kept out of various pursuits. They couldn't be involved in agriculture. There's all sorts of things Jews couldn't be involved in. So they did shtick. They cut corners. The problem is, though, that that could affect the entire community. If the guy, you can make a halachic case, I'm sure, that certain of these illegal activities were permissible halachically because the Jews were oppressed and they couldn't make a living. However, the problem is that then the entire Jewish community was punished, and we had counterfeiting. What they would do is they would make money, they would counterfeit coins, and they would not put in enough gold, all sorts of things. But he says, Mishosu b'zuyufim, and it says, V'yesh lachu sheyazik l'rabim. If there's a fear that it's going to affect the entire community. In Europe, before modern times, the entire community would be punished by the actions, especially when they assumed that people, the Jewish community, knew about it and didn't stop it. You warn him, Matrin Bo, that he shouldn't do this. And if he doesn't listen, V'imeno mashkiach yecholi mumosro. And if he doesn't listen, you can hand him over to the non-Jews. And we know that Jews would routinely hand over, for instance, murderers. Or if someone would rob from non-Jews, they would, the Jewish community would hand them over to the non-Jews. Because if you have a Jewish murderer, for instance, especially if he murders a non-Jew, you can't hide him or anything like that. And that's what the Ramah, and the Ramah repeats it in Tuf Kuf Hey, Mishan Masakin Rabin. If someone who's endangering the masses, the Jewish masses, for example, he's involved in counterfeiting, in a place where the Malchus is Makbid, Dino Kerodef. He has the status of a Rodef. A Rodef means he's causing other people to be put in danger. Umutar l'mosro l'malchus. You can turn him over. And then Rabbi Malka says, V'hani mafitze samim. Those people who distribute drugs, they're sakana to the rabbin. And the government is Makbid on this. And therefore, Mutar l'mosran l'malchus, Rabbi Malka says, halacha l'maisa, you can hand them over. And you don't need to give them any hasra. You don't need to give them any warning. That is, you know that someone down your street is selling drugs. You can call the police and say, there's people on my street selling drugs. You don't even need to warn them, Rabbi Malka says. Why don't you need to warn them? Because everyone knows it's illegal. And he says, because the television and the newspaper, everyone knows to scream about this. And then he brings a raya, another raya. The Gemara in Bab Metzia has a story where, Rabbi Lezer ben Rashbi, he was appointed by the government to find Jewish thieves. And he did. He found them and he turned them in. And even though one of the other Tanaim said to them, Ad masayata moser amoshal kenu hariga, how long are you going to be involved? You're collaborating with the government. The implication is that he was wrong to do that. But Rabbi Malka says that's there they were handing him over to be killed. And because the non-Jews did not follow Torah law, they would kill you for a geneva, for thievery. He says, but today when we get rid of the drug dealer, he's not going to be killed. He's going to be just put in jail. And furthermore, this creates then the fear in them that we're going to do this, and they'll stop selling it. Then he goes on, he speaks about the status of a government. Very interesting. He says that our governments, our democratic governments, this is at the bottom of page Reish of Gimel, they are elected by the people. And the entire nation agrees to this. And they have the authority. They have the authority to punish people who violate the laws. We're not dealing with some king or prince who just makes arbitrary laws. We're a democracy. And the people are in place of the king, where they have the status. And as long as it's, he says, for tikkun ha'olam, I guess it's not only a reform thing to speak about tikkun ha'olam, but he calls it tikkun ha'olam. As long as it's tikkun ha'olam for him is making sure society functions properly, not getting rid of discrimination or anything like that. And as long as the people are, he's quoting Rosh Yisraeli here, are working in the gvulot, in the proper boundaries, that our elected officials have the status, they're our representatives, and they can pass laws. And he concludes the last paragraph that our governments have the status of king, and therefore they are permitted to do what they wish for the tovas hamadina, for the good of the state. And there's nothing better, he says. There's nothing better for the good of the state than getting rid of the drugs, which cause so many problems. I say this sitting in New Jersey, which last week ruled that marijuana is permissible now, 21 and under. But that's okay. You can say marijuana is not hard drugs. That's Siman Sadi Dawood. Sadi, by the way, it's not Sadiq. When I growing up in school, they told us it was Sadiq. That was the how they pronounced the letter, but it's not. There's no kuf at the end. It's Sadiq kuf because the next letter. Although if you look in one of the classic works on how to write a Sefer Torah, it's a Shar Ephraim, Ephraim Margolios. I believe it's in that work. And in many other works as well, they actually spell the letter tzadi as tzadik. You look at it like tzadik, tzadik. What does a tzadik have to do with anything? But it's the letter tzadi that they spell. And we spoke about how to pronounce it should be tzadi, not tzadi. Okay, we're back to now Rabbi Greenblatt. Incidentally, when we finish this section, another couple tshuvot, then you'll be introduced to a whole different array of figures. You've been introduced to Rabbi Greenblatt and Rabbi Moshe Mal, many important figures. But when we move into more historical, philosophical, a whole new cast of characters, I can say great in their own way, but a different type of greatness. These people we've been dealing with are mostly focused on halacha greatness. The others have other areas of greatness. There are a couple who cross both ways. So Rabbi Greenblatt, the great Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, I asked him the same question. And he had a different approach, at least in responsa number one. This is Tishrei of 1986, a long time ago. And he thinks that, no, that you can't just turn someone over to the government. And if you're involved in, like, trying to trap them, he thinks that's lifnei iver. What you can do, he says, is tell them that they're after him and I'm Jewish, you're Jewish, I'm not going to turn you in. But understand that the government knows about you. You should stop this or you're going to go to jail. We're going to see he has a completely different perspective about 8 months later. But that's what he says. I asked him some other questions here. The second, I also asked him about alarms. You have, many of us, I think probably most of us now, have alarms in our houses. So the way it works many times is that when you open the door, like a light goes on. Now, can that light go on Shabbos? You go in and out of the house, and always like a red light goes on, the LED, but whatever, the light goes on. You don't have to. Well, in my house, they turned it off, so you don't see it. But let's say you didn't. Is that an issue? I actually think that most poskim don't see it's an issue. It's not any different than walking down the street. If the light goes on, you don't care. It's the Rabbanon, it's discretion on Michale. I think most wouldn't have an issue, but he thought differently. He thought that you can't go in if it's that way, and therefore on Shabbos, before Shabbos, you would need to leave a window open so that it's always on. That's what he thought. I don't know. Maybe the majority of you ruling is like him. I'm not sure. It's not relevant to me. I mean, everywhere you walk now, you walk down the street, the lights are going on and off. When you're in a hotel, I know they tell you it's not an issue. You walk in a hotel on Shabbos, things are going on, you don't care. Maybe it's different with your house, because your house, it's your property, you can fix it, but I don't know. We assume you walk down the street, all sorts of things happen. We go to shuls on my European trips. We walk through security cameras, all these things. We assume secretion ol michali. Is it a different with your house? I don't know. You have to ask your local rabbi. And then he says in the last paragraph there, and also with a hotel, you can't use those cards. You have to use keys, but it's different with the hotel and the cards, because that you're actually doing something. You're putting it in, putting the card in. When you're walking, it's not, you have no intention. So it's not the same thing. Unfortunately, I never had a chance really to probe this more with Rabbi Greenblatt. And it could be his opinion changed over time. When these things first came out, everyone was machmir. I mean, when we turn on our water on Shabbos, it affects the meter. The poskim have said it really doesn't matter because we don't care, all that. Today, it's impossible to go anywhere without, I remember when Rav Yoshev, it's hard to know whether he said it, came out of his court, but the ruling came that you couldn't go to the Kotel because the cameras would see you. But people said, what do you mean you can't go? How could you not go to the Kotel on Shabbos with cameras? Everywhere you walk in Jerusalem, everywhere you walk in New York, everywhere you walk, we're being, cameras are everywhere on us. So people said he couldn't have said it. It's impossible. I don't know. Maybe he did said it the way they explained it to him. Maybe he didn't realize the situation. But that's not the the general assumption. The poskim generally make a different distinction. Rabbi Vosner was the first one. It was a famous response, and when they first started putting those things in front of houses, that you walk past them and the lights go on. So can you walk down the street because the lights go on? And Rabbi Vosner said that, and he didn't even say you need to go a far street around. If you can walk and walk a little bit out of the way, so you don't. But otherwise, you don't. You walk, and if it goes on, it's not an issue. The one time it would be an issue is you have this also sometimes in hotels. If you should arrange ahead of time that the lights don't go on in the hallways, but if you're stuck, or for instance in Israel, Rabbi Mazuz was asked the question in Israel, this family refused to, this apartment refused to keep the lights on Shabbos. It's when you walked in the hallway, the lights went on. So does that mean you're stuck in your room? You can't go anywhere all of Shabbos? Rabbi Mazuz writes, and I think everyone would agree, the only time this would be a problem is if it's completely dark. That is, you go out in the hallway and it's literally completely dark. I've never seen this. Usually you have lights, emergency lights, because if it's not completely dark, you go out, the lights go on, but you can say it's Sikresha, Lomichale. This is a real tzara. You're supposed to stay, you can't stay in your house all of Shabbos, not go to shul or anything like that. So that's what he rules halacha maisa. Rav Shechter also, he's on, they showed up at a hotel in one of their trips, and lo and behold, Erev Shabbos, the lights go on in the hallway. So he gave a shiur why it's not a problem. In when we go to Budapest, that hotel, I've been arranging it all these years, that the lights go, they leave the lights on. Usually the hotels can arrange to leave them on. But if it's completely dark, then it's not a psik reshon lichole. Then the lights are, you need the lights, and you'd have to claim that you don't intend for it to go on, but you benefit. So it's much more complicated. But I can tell you that over the years, rabbis have become more lenient on these issues because today, everywhere you walk, things are happening. And as I said, every shul you go in Europe, there's a security camera watching you as you go in. And no one said don't go to shul because of that. In Siman, the next Siman, Sadi Vav, which I don't remember why. This is about 8-10 months after the first letter, and maybe I discussed it more with Rabbi Green, but I can't remember why. But now he changes his mind, and he says, now he retracts what he wrote before and says, you do need to, maybe... I really can't remember what the circumstance was. I wrote to him and explained to him why I disagree and why what reasons there were, but he changes his mind. And he says, you can inform someone on your street is selling drugs to the locals. You can inform on that. And this has all sorts of implications. I haven't had a chance. One of you informed me that there was a David Lichtenstein show Shabbos before Saturday night was on Masira about COVID. I'm going to try to listen to it tomorrow on the way to Scranton because this has relevance to COVID. You've had poskim who've said, Rav Asher Weiss and others, that people are going without masks and places and shuls and all that. You can inform on them. The rabbis in Florida came out with the whole letter around Pesach time that if you come down here, we're gonna tell on you and all these things. And others have a different perspective. it's the same general issues, the welfare of the society at large, especially the Jewish community in particular, versus the prohibition on Masira, and how you come down on that also has a lot to do with how you view your place in society, in a secular government like Israel or America. Do you view yourself sort of on the outside as a like a separatist community where it's us against them? Or do you see yourself really as part of the collective? But even if you have the more sectarian view, at the end of the day, you're in shul and someone comes without a mask. Okay, so they would say, yes, it doesn't endanger you because you can leave the shul. But with schools, you have kids sending kids to school. Our kids are going to school now. How can you have a situation where someone's going to send their kids to school where they don't get a flu shot, or they don't get a, they're not going to get the COVID vaccine, or they're sick or something like that? It's then he has a. I asked him a different question. It's funny. He writes to me about Tov Pasakta, that I paskin correctly. I mean, paskin. Who paskin? I was 21 years old. I'm in college. But what happened was as follows. I was asked by someone, this wasn't when I was working here. This is when I was a student. Could he wasn't sure of taking a job and working at a store where they sell non-kosher stuff. Working as a waiter, all these sorts of things. You work at a, not talking about a supermarket, but let's say you work at a place where, like a restaurant. It was like a takeout place. Can a kosher religious Jew, can a Jew work at a place, a store where they sell treif? And he says, you poskined well that you can't work there, and that's the halacha. Rav Greenbaum is actually machmir on this. I only learned that later on, that I've investigated this, and because there's all sorts of issues that I've raised. Well, what does that mean? So can I work at a CVS? CVS sells non-kosher candies there. Can you work at ShopRite? Or is it only working at a non-kosher restaurant? Where do you draw the line? Can you work at UberDash? Lots of, that was called, I think, UberDash? I don't know, the Uber service. I know religious Jews who pick up from restaurants and bring them there. And I have to say, again, I didn't know about the issue, so I never had a chance to really discuss it in more detail with Rabbi Greenblatt. But it seems that most poskim do not see this as a problem. In fact, in Igros Moshe, Yerodea 1, number 51, this goes back to when he was in Russia. He talks about an Eglon, a carriage driver, who can, his job is to bring Basar Chazir, to bring it from one place to the other. He's an early Uber Dash driver. And he says, Ramosha says, since he has Ein lo chelek b'guf ha'isur, because he's not really involved in the Isur per se, he's just delivering, it's not a problem. And if you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, in Yerodea Pei Zayin, something I had really no clue about, he speaks about the innkeepers. Jewish innkeepers would make for their non-Jews, they would fry for them. This is Pei Zayin Sif Yud. They would fry meat with butter. Basar b'chalav. Because this is, it's not clear whether many hold it's the Durabanan. And there's different reasons to be makel on this. Hefsen Meruba, he says. And he says, Dover ze mutzle me'od b'achsan yot. He tells us that it's a, that it's permissible. So we see here, and based on that, many, many people, I was looking, rule that there's no problem, even being a waiter. See, if you look at the sources, many people say you can't be a waiter because you might eat the food. But there's many poskim who say, no, it's not a problem. Just make sure you don't eat it. That's more complicated if you're a cook or a waiter. But where do you draw the line? I wish I was able to ask for a green, but where do you draw the line? You say, can you work in any store? If you have a supermarket, religious Jews have supermarkets. Does that mean everything in the supermarket needs to be kosher? And can you work at the supermarket? That means that you're the checkout person. What's the problem with that if it's sealed? These are issues you can ask your local rabbi, but these were the things I was speaking about. In fact, a good friend of mine, he worked as a waiter one summer at a non-kosher catering hall. And I don't know what fun that is, because I worked in a kosher catering hall also, and as a waiter. Part of the fun, much of the fun, is eating the food and then bringing home the leftovers. My mother would be happy I bring home the leftovers, but I can't imagine working at a place, not to mention the fact when you bring out real tarfus, crabs and all that, it's, you know, it's like disgusting to the smell. But he did, and he's a frum guy, but he needed the money. So again, ask for a local Orthodox rabbi, but I was looking online, and that's what I came up with. Okay, now we're up to Siman 97, Reish Tes Zion. And this is from Rabbi Avinir, who we've spoken about a number of times. And it's a two-part question. The second part relates to this idea of dat umedina that we've been speaking about, how governments function. The first part is not. So I'm going to stick now. Let's begin with the first part. And this relates, the title is Shitas HaRambam Mitzias HaShadim, the view of the Rambam when it comes to demons. So demons are not really so popular anymore with the rise of modern science, and we understand bacteria and why all sorts of things happen. Demons are not something that most people focus on, but if you learn Gemara, at least in much more in Bavli than Yerushalmi, they refer to demons and Shadim, Mazikin, and I think in traditional circles, at least the ones I've been in, they still see this as a reality. The Rambam did not regard this as reality. In the passage from the Vilna Gaon, we saw the few classes ago, the Vilna Gaon attacks the Rambam for denying demons, and many of the philosophers denied the existence of demons. Although it's not really a question of, it's not an empirical issue. Incidentally, Ibn Ezra, who was also a philosopher, he believed in demons. They didn't, Rambam denied demons and the others, not because it wasn't empirical. It was just they had philosophical reasons. But there's no reason, the idea that you can assume the existence of a being that we don't see, we believe in bacteria, we don't see it. We believe in COVID and we don't see it. So just because you're a philosopher doesn't mean that you would reject demons. But the Rambam, for a variety of reasons, he rejected it. For those who are interested in the Rambam's view, I published a book 2008. It's called Studies in Maimonides and His Interpreters. And the first section deals with principles of interpretation in the Rambam. One of my big ideas is that the academic world is fond of pointing out that the traditional interpreters, traditional commentators, they overlook important things, and therefore often their interpretations are lacking. They don't know about languages, and they don't care about manuscripts, that sort of thing. And there's a lot of truth to that. But on the other hand, the academic modern scholars overlook much that the traditional interpreters offer. And what I try to show is how you find much of like modern type of scholarship, even in the traditional interpreters, and a proper interpretation of the Rambam, Gemara, anything has to take into account all of it. The second part of the book is called Maimonidean Halacha and Superstition, in which I discuss all the examples that I could find. Subsequently, I found some more. It's a fairly long chapter where the Rambam deletes superstitions in the Gemara, in the Halacha even, because sometimes the Halacha is based on the superstition, how he deals with it. And that's going to be with this question. I have to mention, though, that an unfortunate error. There's no perfection in this world. Every time I do a post, I always find a Ruvain from Paris, he finds the typos. I read it over three times, and lots of people read it over, but if it's not, if it's your native language, you miss it. But Ruvain from Paris, he always finds the couple typos. There was a mistake, the very last word of the book. And let me tell you about it, because I think you'll find it of interest. Not in the one I'm holding, because it was reprinted. But on Amazon, if you order it, it's $10, not very expensive. Some of them, people have told me they got the book with the mistake and others not. So what's the mistake? Okay. Let me tell you a story here, because I have an appendix. It's called A Note on Maimonides and Muhammad. I wrote an art, and I tell the story in the introduction to the book. I wrote an essay on Jewish views of Islam. And as part of the essay, I discussed medieval Jews referred to Muhammad in certain negative ways. it's incredible that they could do this, because even though they were writing in Arabic, in Hebrew characters, nevertheless, or in Hebrew, there were plenty of Jewish apostates, and all they needed, they could turn them in. They could, like we spoke about turning in drug dealers. But yet you have see over and over again negative discussions and negative phrases and words about Muhammad, that you would never do that today in Pakistan or any place like that. They would execute you. And yet we see them doing it, which is incredible. It's almost as if it was more open then than it is today. So, for instance, the Rambam refers to Muhammad as Hapasul, the unfit one. That is a play on the Arabic term Rasul, which means like the apostle, or that's what Muslims refer to Muhammad as, the Rasul. So the Rambam calls him the Pasul, which means the unfit one. The other way he refers to Muhammad is Meshuga, the crazy one. And this is actually, well, I'll show you the verse that I claim it comes from, but it's a, there was, Muhammad was accused of being possessed by a jinn. A jinn is, well, you remember I Dream of Genie? We all remember that? A genie, that's a jinn. Jinn are these creatures that Muslims believe in. It's part of, it's in the Quran, these that, like a poltergeist, they take you over you, and they, I don't know, actually, is poltergeist the right term? Where they like during a seance, you know, the person is possessed, they possess you. And poets were thought to be inspired by a jinn, and these spooky beings. So Muhammad was accused of being taken over by a jinn, because that would explain the Quran, which is supposed to be the most beautiful Arabic. And the idea is Muslims believe Muhammad was illiterate. So if you say that Muhammad was possessed by a jinn, it's that that's what he became crazy, possessed by the jinn. It's a heresy for Muslims. So in my article that I published, which appeared in Judaism magazine, I explained where this idea of Meshuga, calling Muhammad a Meshuga, a crazy man, came from. And lo and behold, the article appears, and I look at it. And when I saw the proofs, everything was in there. The article appears, and this is removed. And this is taking us back to the 1990s, 1993, if I recall. And I'm looking, and all of a sudden, it's removed. What's going on here? I thought it must be a mistake or something. I call up. I could not believe that Judaism magazine, which was, and I will not say the editor who told me this because he's since passed on and I don't need to say it, but I described this in the introduction to the book. He told me that they decided not to include it because they don't want to offend the Muslims. And therefore they took it out. They didn't even tell me. And at the time, I found this to be outrageous. This is scholarship, I said. We can't be guided by political correctness. This is before you could actually be killed for things like this. In the introduction to the book, when I tell the story, I also don't want to be killed. I say that, I'll read it to you, that Muslims who see this should understand that its intent is not to insult their prophet, but rather to clarify a historical issue. And that's the background. So I decided then to put it in the book. By the way, this is a real issue today, because the other day in my religion class, I started talking about what happened in, because I always bring in religion in the news. Students find it interesting. There's always religion in the news. Everything from the last Supreme Court justice, you know, the role her Catholic beliefs. For all, there's always religion in the news. So we're talking about, you know, the images of Muhammad and the killing of him. And I was about, because I had this big screen behind me on the computer, and I was going to show them the image, the cartoon. And then I hesitated, and I didn't do it. And I said, you can see the images online. Now, why didn't I do that? None of my students are Muslim. None of them are going to be offended or anything. We should see it to see what it is. But I was worried, because the person in France wasn't killed by one of the students. It was put online. One of my students can then go on Facebook and say, we learned something really interesting today, and the professor showed this image. And that could go to that person. And before you know it, now it's saying that Shapiro and Scranton is showing the images. That's exactly what happened in France. So I think it's far-fetched. Obviously, the guy in France thought it was far-fetched. So I refused to show it. So in a sense, they've won. Because I, in America, refused to show the students the image, because I really am afraid that there's a possibility that this could happen. In any event, getting back to the story, so I tell where it comes from, and I point out as follows, that already in a lot of people have pointed out, they say it comes from this verse in Hosea. If you look in Hosea chapter 9, verse 7, you have the expression, Evil Hanavi Meshuga Isha Ruach, which means the prophet is a fool, the man of the spirit is man. So here you have Evil Hanavi Meshuga. So because there it refers to, we don't want to call him a prophet, but he is like a man of the spirit. But Ruach can be in a negative sense. Therefore, they called him Meshuga from this verse. And that's accepted. That's a standard scholarly view. It's also mentioned, I point out, that even in the 14th century, someone says that. But and here's an example of what you can get from traditional interpretation. None of the modern scholars knew what I am going to tell you now, that in a rabbinic work, it points out, so this is the value of rabbinic works, even to clarify modern scholarship, that crucial for applying this pasuk, Meshuga Isha Ruach, Meshuga to Muhammad, because there's lots of verses that speak about false prophets, is the previous verse. Look in the very previous verse. Mahmad al-Khafisbam. Mahmad is Muhammad in Hebrew. So it's the fact that in verse 6 it says Muhammad, Mahmad, doesn't mean Muhammad, of course, in Hebrew, but I mean, that's how it's written. So because you have the allusion to Muhammad there in verse 6, in verse 7, it's Meshuga. At least that's the claim I made. The problem is the very last word in the book. Well, it's the last word because Hebrew, it ends the sentence. It says, I quote the verse, and instead of Mahmar al-Khaspam Kimoshi Rashem, it says Mahmar. And since the Hebrew is, it's going the four words, the very last word in some of the printings has machmar. But if you get it from me, it'll be correct, machmar. So what is this, getting back to the article on superstition? I make the claim in my article, in my book. It also was a long article that then I turned into a book, that the Rambam never explicitly denies the existence of demons. There's no question he denies demons. The Grub mentioned it. I have a list of like 20 Achronim who pointed out a Rishonim. They all know he denies it, but he doesn't explicitly. You see that he denies it because you see how he deals with various halachot that he just leaves it out. There were a few figures who couldn't believe it, who said it's impossible. He couldn't deny it. Some even said that, like the Minchas Elazar said that he acted like he didn't believe it because people were being attached to like idolatry related to demons, but he really did believe it. He calls it an Avera Lishma. But the Kutzker said that when the Rambam, the demons existed, but when the Rambam Paskin, there are no demons, then God got rid of the demons. The problem was, and the reason I wrote to Rav Avinir, is that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook said that the Rambam believed in demons. So I wrote to Rav Avinir saying, how could Rav Tzvi Yehuda, it's in a book that Rav Avinir published with Tzvi Yehuda, how could Rav Tzvi Yehuda say the Rambam believed in demons? We all know the Rambam didn't believe in demons. So next week we will see his answer to me. And then the second question dealt, and this is why it's in this section here, uprooting settlements in Judea, Samaria, Gaza, which I wrote to, I'll tell you about the question I wrote to Rav Avinir. Rav Avinir told the people that they should leave when the government says to leave. And I found that strange for reasons I'll mention. And then we'll get two other questions dealing with society, I guess you could say. And then we move into a completely different area, different subjects. You'll be introduced to, as I said, a whole new group of great rabbinic figures. And if halacha is not your thing, well, we're moving into new territory coming up very soon, God willing. Next week, the 250th class. Although Rabbi Kelman last week said that 250, that's not important for us. Last week, 248, that's 248 and 365. Those are important in terms of Judaism, the mitzvot. But okay, well, maybe if I remember next week, we'll make something of that. So I will stop. We're going to pick up next class right here. Let me get to the questions. And thank you all for coming. Those who are enjoying the podcast, you could go to the podcasts. They haven't yet got it put on Spotify. They will. But the podcasts are very easy. Just go to Torah in Motion. They're free. You can, but we'll get them on Spotify. But if you enjoy some of the stuff we do, you can go to the Sfarim blog. I just put out a post. There's lots of posts. You should go anyway, even if not for me, to read what Jonathan Boyarin wrote about Rav David Feinstein. So Mel points out that the website has thousands of MP3 files, zero podcasts. I don't exactly know what a podcast is. They call it a podcast. I thought if you can download it to your phone and listen to it, you're in the car. At least I thought that was a podcast, but I guess you can listen to it. Put it that way. Yaakov Yellen says his Rebbe, Rav David, was very careful not to paskin regarding anything while his father was alive. Only afterwards was he willing to issue a psak. One of the people, if you read Jonathan Bayarin's essay, he even says that Rav David, it's almost like he consciously didn't want to be a personality. He didn't, he was a very modest person, you can just see. I mean, he never wore the garb, the long coats. He was, I've heard him on a number of different videos and things, and without even knowing him, just the sense I get is, tells it like it is. There's a video of Rabbi Moshe Snow. I recommend everyone to watch it on YouTube. Just Google Moshe Snow or Moshe Feinstein. He was a Rebbe at JC when Yeshiva and Elizabeth and I was there. And he was very close to Ramosha, close to the whole family. And he was fortunate to have a car. His parents had a car. So he was able to drive Ramosha around. Oh, lots of interesting stories. He's not going to tell you about Lundus. Which of us can speak about Ramosha's Lundus? But he speaks about Ramosha, the person. He spoke about the basketball tournament that Yellen was actually on the basketball team. But the point he stresses is that when you were with Ramosha, and this should not be seen, if you're not in the yeshiva world, you might think this is offensive, what I'm going to say now. But everyone from yeshiva knows what I'm talking about. He says, when you're with Ramosha, not just Ramosha, Rav David Reuven, you sense that they were normal. And so most people who are not yeshivas, you're thinking, well, that's a compliment. They're normal. What do you mean they're normal? You're implying they might be abnormal, but normal means something different. When we say normal, we don't mean like a crazy man. But in yeshivas, you know that we have their imuyim, their gaonim, but they're not, they can't speak to people. Their whole mind is wrapped up in their learning, and they don't have social graces, social cues. Ramosha Feinstein said, this is quoted by Rabbi Shurkin in his book, that we have lots of problems with the Iluyim, geniuses, because, you know, a Rav is not just a book person. You could be the greatest Talmudic scholar in the world. It's not a Rav. A Rav needs to deal with people. Rav Chaim says the most important thing of a Rav is helping people. If you listen to the eulogy, Rav David Feinstein, half the time he's going around raising money for this and that, helping this tzedakah, that tzedakah. That's what real Rabbanim do. They don't just learn. And when in yeshivas, when you say about this great Talmud Chacham, he's not normal, it means that you can't speak to him. He can't understand your issues. So all he does is learn, and that's fine. He can just learn. But that's in yeshivas when you say, like Ramosha was normal, it means that even though he's the God of the door, and we don't even have an inkling of what he knows and what he is. You can go to him and talk about your matters, and he can understand you and appreciate you. That's what it means, normal. So that's the sense. And you listen to the Hesped, that's what you heard good things, and you got a real sense of appreciation. I'll just tell you the story because it's a great story. At least I think it's great. I'm sure that you have Kanaim who are offended by this, but Rabbi Snow tells the following story, and he says about Rav Reuven, but it's the same thing. You know, he's giving an example of normal, that his daughter went to Beis Yaakov, and when her brother got married, so she had to walk, I think it was her brother, and I said she had to walk down the aisle. She's 18, and she didn't think it was sneeze to walk down the aisle. Boys are going to be looking at her and all this. So Rabbi Snow says to her, you know, he's having a big problem. She won't walk down the aisle. He says, well, we can call Rav Reuven. If Rav Reuven says you can walk down the aisle, will you walk down the aisle? She says, well, yes, if Rav Reuven says it. So you have to listen to the way Rabbi Snow describes it and the reaction of the crowd. But this is what he says. So they called Rav Reuven. And the first thing Reuven asked is, how old is she? And he says, well, she's 18. So he says, well, okay, so she's ready to be a kala soon. So I want you to tell her she has to walk down the aisle and she has to look good. You know, so, and Rabbi Snow gave that as an example of being like an understanding of the world. So Rabbi Yaakov Yellen says, oh, we heard that. So Baruch, the Paraduma video, in recent years, I've noted a few of them. Has any of them panned out? I don't know. The Paraduma video was very interesting because the guy showing them around is a Jewish guy who knows Yiddish. His parents were Holocaust survivors, but he clearly doesn't know how to act when he's with a great Rosh Hashiva. It's not just the second button's unbuttoned, the third button's unbuttoned, and he's walking around like he's on a beach with his chain there and his shirt's open. But you see, he had the Yiras HaKavod at the end. The way he speaks to Rav David, you see the respect he had for him. But it's funny, the Rav David is walking, this guy's talking to him in Yiddish about the cow. You know, and he's a farmer, maybe from the days by Adelphia when they had the farmers down there. I don't know if it panned out, if they found any black on it. Carlsbach tell us that everyone wears a poppy. I had never seen it before. Baruch says that while you made a Yom Limud Tefillah for the Zechus of Rabbi Sachs, right after we heard about it. We all heard about it, but I thought it was just in the initial stages. I can tell you that I spoke to one of the rabbis in London today by WhatsApp, and he told me that they were just as surprised. At least he said they were, unless it happens sometimes that you get the diagnosis and it's very fast. Yes, Rabbi, you point out Rabbi Jacobowitz was a public intellectual and very prominent. He was. But he spoke about medical ethics. He made medical ethics a field even, but he didn't have the reach. Part of it perhaps is because of the internet. But also Rabbi Sachs was trained in philosophy. He could speak about things that Rabbi Jacobowitz couldn't speak about. Yeah, the United Kingdom is a very small group of Jews. And if you think how many Jews there are, what are they, 200, 250,000? How many of them are Orthodox? And of the Orthodox, how many are Haredi? Yeah, you don't count them. So the United Synagogue is just the shuls like in London. So he has a bigger role in the sense that it has symbolic. He's the chief rabbi. But how many really follow him? Not that many. But that would be as an official role. But he went beyond all roles. It's incredible what he achieved, and we're going to need to have important studies of his ideas, of his philosophy, of his influence. And they liked him more. The Christians liked him much more than the Archbishop of Canterbury. You never like your own clergyman telling you something, but he had a way with the English language, and he really was a Kiddush Hashem, because he was able to make traditional Judaism appealing and was able to spread the so that non-Orthodox Jews, when they wanted a voice of Judaism, they would look to him. And the other one says, you heard him when he was Marble Arch. He was not well then, but you heard him give a Shabbos Drusha, and you thought he was destined for greatness. Yes, the second to last time I was with him, I was in London at Marble Arch. He would come once a year for Shabbos, and he was there that Shabbos, and he spoke, and it was magnificent. Rabbi Sachs gave me the advice in 2008. That's when he gave me that advice. And Yellen says about Sachs wrote that his radical work, yes, either the Haredi basically were going to put him in Chayrim. And he had to retract his work on other religions. Did he really retract it, or he just retracted it to so he wouldn't be put in chevron by them? There was a huge dispute between him and the Haredi world, because he argued in his book, The Dignity of Difference, that Jews do not have the complete truth, that their other religions could also have truths that we do not have. And when I say truths, I don't mean truths in a sense that they don't kill. You know, that's a truth. No, I mean specific theological truths that they have been given through revelation or through insight, whatever it is. It's a very radical view, although I have to say that there is Rav Natanael ben Yeshaya in the medieval pretty much approaches that. And I tried to make the case if I would write the review now, and in my book, I mention this, in Rav Kook's newest work, or one of his newest works, L'Invochei Hador, he basically says the same thing that Jonathan Sacks says. But the response in the Haredi world was extreme. And they got Rav Yoshev to put him, to place the book that it should be under the ban. And Mel says, right, Meir Soloveitchik speaks, he quotes Rav Sacks very often. I have to say that Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, you might not like his politics. He's very conservative with a small c. But in terms of a public intellectual and speaking on issues of the day, you can read him in commentary and First Things. He is exactly what Rabbi Sachs was saying, that traditional Jews, rabbis, need to bring Jewish wisdom to the world at large, because we are not a parochial religion. We forget that sometimes. But the Torah is not just for the Jews. The Torah has a message for the entire world. And not just the Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach, the whole ideas of ethics and morality, this idea that we, you know, revert to our communities, this is not, and are not interested in the outside world. This is at least from Jonathan Sachs's perspective, Shimshon Avraham Hirsch, etc., this is not what we should be doing. So Rabbi, we have others who are going to be there. Jonathan Helfand, who I don't know, I think he's out in Pepperdine, I believe, but he's written for the Wall Street Journal. There's a number of young YU rabbis who are, Saul, I think his name is Zuckier, I forget his first name. There's a number of young rabbis who, I don't know who influenced them. Maybe it was Jonathan Sachs. He was at YU for a couple of years, who've begun writing for general periodicals. And it's a really a new phenomenon, but I give Soloveitcher credit for in America being the one to really do that. And look, I had him come to Scranton twice to speak. You can go on my university website and you could hear one of his talks about torture. You know, he's always a contrarian that why you torture could be good, or at least not bad in certain circumstances. You can hear him debating Rabbi Aryeh Klapper and one of the other people. But I couldn't get him now to come speak unless I paid him a lot of money. He's very popular now. He spoke for the Republican National Convention. But I knew he was something before other people did. Yellen says the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act makes it illegal for American citizens to pay a bribe to any official of a non-U.S. government with heavy penalties. And as my neighbor said to me, though, we couldn't get in. He admitted he was breaking the law. I guess it's against Din Mahusa, so it's against Halacha also, I would say. Rabbi Meodid was speaking where it's not against the government. He was speaking just bribery, not when it's against Din Mahusa. He's a big believer in Din Mahusa in practice, Rabbi Meodid. But I guess then you'd have to define what a bribe is. If you bring a necklace for, I guess that's a bribe, yeah. So, but you couldn't get in. He says it was absolutely impossible to get any contracts in these African countries without, you couldn't get the licenses you need. He said, impossible. iPad says, regarding donkey milk, the mistake was asking a rabbi. If I felt the item was a legitimate cure for father and mother, I would absolutely drink it if needed to induce the sick to also drink. Okay, so could be, but he did ask the question, and usually Orthodox Jews do ask the questions. And I understand the answer. If the father's committing suicide, father's not following halacha. The halacha is he has to drink it, and he's going to be pious and say, I can't. The Rambam says you have the status of a suicide. If the halacha is you have to violate Shabbos or Kashrus, and you refuse, you say, I'm so pious, I'm not going to, and then you cause yourself to die, you have the status of a suicide. I still don't know why, though, if anyone called us and said, I'm going to jump off the building now, we all would get in the car, and the rabbis would tell us to get in the car. We saw the video from the rabbi from Lakewood saying that if you have to call your sponsor, don't hesitate. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, this is probably about 15 weeks ago, the sponsor could be a Jewish person. And he's saying, of course you have to pick it. So I don't know. I'll think about that. Mel says, if the father doesn't drink the milk, he won't die right away. For the fellow threatening to commit suicide, his death is imminent. Okay, that is true, but why is that relevant? They thought this was a refua baduka. They thought this was a refua to drink the milk. Ellen says, in Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses on rows that mark our place. Mel says, Rav Rimon discussed the issues of lights going on yesterday at TIM. So you got to tell us what he said. He whetted my appetite. And David Lichtenstein spent a lot of time on the podcast talking about COVID issues. I'm going to listen to that. David Lichtenstein, because of his position, not only does he get the interesting guests, including a guest who was with us on our Morocco trip last January, Rabbi Reisman from Los Angeles, who was speaking. He's an expert. He's written a lot about the surrogate mothers things. But he also, because of his position, he pushes back. And he's able to push back. When David Lichtenstein thinks he's hearing nonsense or something that doesn't make sense, he pushes back. He's a bit like the guy out in Los Angeles, the very wealthy guy. What's his name again? I'm forgetting his name. Who gives all the money to the yeshivas. I forget. Someone has to type in his name. Rechnitz. So Rechnitz can come to Lakewood and tell him off for not accept. He can say things. So more power to them. Ellen, delivery to a Jew is not Leif Neiver. According to the standard post scheme, that I saw looking, I'm talking about major postings. If Rav Moshe mentions it, it is not leaf neighbor to deliver to a non-Jew. Uber Eats, that's it. DoorDash, I said Uberash. The Uber Dash, I was combining the two. Carla Karlsbach, her copy of the book has Machmar instead of Machmad. If you order from Amazon, I can tell you that it's the luck of the draw what you get. But if you order from me, it'll always say Machmad. Because what happened is when they ordered new copies, they're all, it depends what where they stick it from. The person who quite privately wrote to me, you have to send Liberty Valance to send it to me again or I'll forget it. Because once we leave, I don't have the videos. Moshe Snow, then Midge, was my basketball coach at MTJ in high school. I saw him last. I hadn't seen him in 30 years when I spoke at his show, Young Israel of Borough Park, in December. But he would play basketball with the students. And this is the exact thing that when Rabbi Steinman came to America, I wrote about Rabbi Steinman in my last post. He was speaking to the Malamdim, the Rebbes, and they mentioned, you know, about how playing basketball with the kids, and just, I don't know what the detail of the question was, and Rabbi Steinman was shocked, and he told them, you can't play basketball, that's not, you can't do that, and he made the claim that the student has to respect the Rebbe, and if you play basketball with them, they're not going to have that distance, and later, I think it was Rishul Kamenetsky, or one of the other people, the Moetzes, says that we can't go with Rabbi Steinman with this, and Eretz Yisrael, they don't play ball, they don't have any sports or anything, and he doesn't understand the Metzius here, that the best way for a Rebbe to have a connection to the students is to play basketball with them. And that in America, the separation of Rebbe Talmud, like they would have in Europe, certainly in high school, you cannot have that. So Mel says a podcast is what you need, a podcast app and you subscribe. Yes, they're going to get it. I told them they got to get it on Spotify and the rest. Maggie Thatcher was a big admirer of Lord Jacobowitz. Certainly, she's the one, she made sure he became a lord, and he was a conservative, and he was a very conservative voice. And he did speak as a public intellectual beyond medical ethics, as Baruch mentions, but he was very conservative, and it was quite political. It wasn't, Sachs was much more influential and not as political. Yeah, Zuki. Finally, getting to the ends here. When I say Berlitzin's position, Berlitzin's a big Baal Tzedakah. So in the real world, when you have a lot of money and you can, your voice can be heard in a way, and if it's a positive voice, it's a good thing. And both these people, Lichtenstein and Rechnitz, have a lot of positive things to say, and it's fortunate that because of their wealth, they're given the opportunity to say it. I mean, it's not fair that the average person might have a good thing to say either. But as long as we're dealing in the real world, in each of them has positive things to say and good things to say. And yes, he is a big Baal Tzedakah to the Clintons. I'll end with this because I don't want to get political, but when he was attacked, because you can be sure that of his show, people listen to his show, 90%+ are not supporters of Hillary or of Biden or anything. So you got to give Lichtenstein credit for going into the lion's den. But he said one time, I don't need to apologize. Rabbi Menachem and Ganak agrees with me, and he's the Rav HaMachshir of America. So that's what Lichtenstein said. So take it for what it's worth. No one says he doesn't have Das Torah. He doesn't have, you don't have to accept his political views, but I appreciate the interesting shows he puts on. And the fact that he brings in people from the Haredi, from the modern Orthodox Rabbanim, I give him a lot of credit. And he is a Talmud Chacham, and he puts effort into the show. At the same time, he's very involved in business. Most people in his position, and I know many of them, when they make it big, they don't learn anymore. And if they learn, it means they go to a Daf Yomi Shir, or they make believe like they're learning. He mamish learns, and he writes. So, and yes, he's a Mechutin of Rameir Goldwach. So I don't agree with a lot of the things he says, but I have enormous respect for him that he hasn't forgotten where he came from, and he still learns and writes and does these things. And I recommend his books on halacha, modern halacha. And we've had a number of email back and forth about things. So I thank you all. Rabbi Kelman just joined us. I see he was busy speaking.
As somebody mentioned, yeah, I'm coming. I walked in as you were talking on Rabbi Sacks. So Mizrahi of Canada just did a tribute. They had 475 people online. So it shows you his influence. And I don't know why, but they insisted that I speak for a few minutes. So whatever. So I spoke. So that's why I couldn't be here. But you did repeat some of the things. You alluded to some of the things that came up. You know, J.J. Schechter was the keynote speaker. And then they had a few of the local rabbis here in Canada, Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa, to offer a few words. But anyways, it was very nice. But he was a special person for sure. And, you know, I just got this book as a birthday present last week from my in-laws, the latest book, Morality. They were saying, what can they go buy for my birthday? So latest book, Jonathan Sacks. They did say, by the way, they're going to be coming out. Koren is coming out with his Pirush on Chumash. That's what they were working on now. So all right, then we should have a happy, it's been, you know, a tough year in the modern Orthodox world. Rabbi Lam, Adin Steinsaltz, Yenachem Rabinovich, and now Rabbi Sacks, all within, I don't know, 3-4 months of each other. So it's, what can I say? It's a new generation has to come to the fore. I heard that you were talking about a little bit, some of the new public.
And I just want to remind you that next week is the 250th Mark Shapiro class on Torah in Motion.
Ah, there you go.
listen, when you're doing it every week like we are now, the numbers build up quickly.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's good every week. We're gonna keep at it. Please God, once the Pfizer vaccine, Bezrat Hashem, is working in a couple months, we still want to keep Zoom going the way it is.
So. And let me just say, for all you who are listening live, and because event, and those who listen on YouTube, eventually Rabbi Kelman will get it, that when you go on YouTube, this is the first thing you see, that you're getting great benefits, all these wonderful classes. He's too kind, modest to do this, but I'll say he does an amazing job, works very hard. And I would just ask everyone, if you're enjoying the classes, go to the website, donate $50, make a nice donation. You're getting the amount of high quality stuff you're getting here for free. And you can get on YouTube, the hours, and Rabbi Kelman, no one's paying him to do, you know, all this time he's putting in just to people have to put this stuff up. They have to edit it and everything to keep it going. And he doesn't charge anymore because he wants to spread Hagia Torah Adira, to spread it, Yafutzimana Techachutza, to spread all of it. But therefore, it's people we ask to, if you can afford
Thank
it,
you.
If,
Thank
after
you.
Today, after today, I think many of you can afford it a little better than yesterday. So I thank you for that. I'm finished. And
thank you very much. Listen, I was talking today. I was mentioning that we've had about 250 classes on Zoom, I would say, since March, the end of March. I don't think I've ever once asked for donation online. It's in my email. Click here, make a donation. But that, you know, people just ignore that. So I want to thank you. And it's true. We are totally dependent on donations. Without donations, we cannot run the organization. So I'll second what Mark say. I'll go a step further. $50 is nice, and that's great. But those who can afford more, if you would like to sponsor a Zoom class, go on the website to actually sponsor costs. And believe me, I'm not sure the cost of sponsorship actually covers the actual cost of running class. Things are more expensive than people might imagine. So I don't want to go too on about it. We appreciate all the help. And there are people who are, you know, are very generous, and we appreciate and we thank you. But yes, that would be wonderful if you can donate. And, you know, every day to have two classes, you know, which is what we've been doing really for the last while, is it adds up. But thank you. But yes, we want everybody to learn Torah. You know, that's Torah, you know, for everybody. So we, but you should do what you can. Thank you. And we look forward to tomorrow morning, Simi Peters, 11 o'clock on her second class on Midrash. Those were there last week. Really quite interesting, fascinating. So we look forward to seeing with you, learning with you. Everybody have a wonderful night. And maybe I just got this book. And now, obviously, it's like after Dr. Lam passed away, I spent a week reading, you know, rereading some of his books. This isn't rereading. I have to read it for the first time. But you know, Jonathan Sacks wrote so much beautiful things. So we should have good occasions, happy occasions. Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you for 249 classes. We look forward to class 250 next week. Thank you, everybody. Have a Laila Tov. Bye-bye.